The Bat Segundo Show has long been a program in which indecency is prized above good old-fashioned professionalism, a light-hearted tone is considered before seriousness, and conversational anarchy trumps boilerplate questions. How unthinkable to use the podcasting medium as an alternative to the humorless asperity of NPR, the three-minute questions of Michael Silverblatt that don't give an author a chance to respond, the enticing lifelessness of Sam Tannenhaus' weekly podcast at the New York Times, and the pretentious-sounding vacuity of This American Life. It has become abundantly clear that Bat Segundo has strayed too far from the safe and sane path. With this in mind, we hope that you will enjoy a more refined approach to the way we record our intros, starting with this new conversation with author Lydia Millett. Okay, so I am here with Lydia Millett, most recently the author of How the Dead Dream. Lydia, how are you doing?
I am sleepy but well.
Oh,
thank you.
That's good. Well, I wanted to start off by discussing this notion of ideology. I suppose it is inflicting our nation as well, that creeps into your protagonist here. Here he is, driven by this capitalist mentality on the onset. And this is in stark contrast to this empathy that burgeons its way through the book. And I wanted to sort of ask you, this seems to me, of all of your books, perhaps the most explicitly rooted in ideology, particularly as it is related to national character. So I wanted to ask you how dwelling upon this ideology came about.
Well, I think the nation notion snafu that you just made, or whatever that was, gaffe or Freudian slip, was a good one, because I've just been quite overwhelmed by the capacity of the current presidential administration to be ideological and to sort of to ignore, steamroll science and to wage this sort of war against endangered species. And I work every day around information about animals vanishing and plants vanishing. So it was a very natural thing to write at this time for me. And of course, capitalism. I mean, there's no more fruitful subject for fiction.
Well, it's also T's concern for endangered species almost suggests that his empathy is something of an endangered species as well. And I wanted to ask you about that particular connection.
Well, all my books have to do with empathy, really. Yeah. You know, I'm very interested in that. Always interested in people's ability to step beyond themselves or not, and I do think people are naturally empathic, and so it's not a book against those who don't have empathy, really. It's sort of a book that seeks to cultivate empathy in certain arenas, for example with those pigeons that just flocked overhead. The rats of the bird world, as they say.
So
empathy is just constantly something that I think it's the thing I write about most.
Yeah.
Probably in all my books, and most overtly in this one.
I wanted to also ask you about T's parents, particularly his mother, who you have as this almost angelic figure. You start off by having her hair almost yellowish. In fact, this is the only real concern for hair color in your book. And then gradually...
You really pick up on the details.
Well, I do. I try. You do put them in there. But then, over the course of it, this hair grays. And it was very interesting to me because it's close to how you describe the landscape, which is graying, which is being invaded. The environment is being invaded by all this progress of conspicuous consumption and the like. And so I wanted to ask you, in terms of this relationship between humans and the environment, how it's reflective in this particular hair color, and how many details do you really need in the particular character in order to carry on a theme like this? Or is it more of a, as you've alluded to me before, sort of a subconscious thing?
Yeah, it is. Or unconscious even. But I do think people turn gray when the world around them turns gray. Extraordinarily literal about it. And this book is very much about the graying of the world, the graying over of the world, and people's responses to that. And that would be my cell phone.
Oh, no worries.
So I will... Didn't this happen in our other interview, too? Or am I...
No, it didn't.
It did not.
Oh, I know. It happened in a reading that I gave the other day.
Ah.
It's even better. It's terrible when you're the one reading and then you're the one with the obnoxious cell phone. It was at Yale, and there was a very august room full of students.
And your cell phone actually rings.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in notion, the notion of symbols in this, I mean, surely you had to be at least vaguely cognizant of
For example, T's early episode where he runs over the animal, and this kind of kickstarting this relationship that he has with animals, and he has with environments, and he has with this state of nature. And then, of course, the state of nature, which we haven't even talked about. So I want to ask you, you know, how much really is design? I mean, I don't entirely believe you that it's entirely random.
Well, it's not sort of design at the outset, generally. It just there's always an innate design that rises to the fore as you write through a book, I think. There's some sort of thing that surfaces, and I don't plan out in a calculating way, really, how my books are going to be structured, though I used to when I was a younger writer. But, yeah, hitting the animal is just a very sort of part of a fairly literal progression. Also, roadkill is a thing that urban and rural people encounter. I mean, we encounter dead animals all the time in our lives, just everywhere. Everything is a dead animal in a certain sense. What we eat, what we see. There's just a lot of dead animals around us, and there are a lot of dead animals in this trilogy. The third one, which I'm working on now, has to do with taxidermy. And so dead animals.
The death comes full circle, it seems. Yeah.
As well as live ones. I'm interested in how we relate to both.
Are animals kind of a logical? I mean, obviously you're dealing with the ecosystem, so therefore it seems to me that if you are a novelist of systems or ideas, that animals would serve as that kind of really galvanizing motif to launch into this inquiry. Do you need to kind of have a sort of situation in which you're kind of examining a system from almost a kind of side glance, and then there kind of let the wild pastures bear fruit? Or?
I think that's very fitting and very fitting metaphor. The wild pastures bear fruit. I don't think pastures actually bear fruit. But
pastures don't bear fruit. But it just
pastures are for cows. So yeah. The animals again rear their heads.
The mulberry bushes, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I do sort of go sideways into things sometimes, but then I end up tackling things quite head on, I think, compared to a lot of novelists, because I want to tackle them head on, and I want fiction to be engaged in things in sort of, I don't know, lay philosophy and ideas and social issues in a fairly direct way. At least I want my fiction to do that. And I like it when other people's fiction does it too.
You alluded earlier that you wanted to scale down this idea of having sort of a big mammoth systems Gaddis-like book into what I suspect here is being more, I guess, accessible or populist for the reader. I'm wondering why it is that these big novels aren't of concern for you anymore. And is it really just a matter of wanting to reach out to more readers, getting them to sort of think more about the notions of empathy and notions of our relationship with animals and environment and the like?
Yeah, you know, there was a time in my life when I thought that my ideal would be to be a writer whose fiction crossed over, sort of, and that was the moment where I wrote, for instance, George Bush Struck Prince of Love, which I thought of as a very accessible and not particularly literary effort to draw in readers who might not read as much in literature as I did then. But since then, I've sort of abandoned that as a goal. That is, I would love, of course, more people to read in general, and more people to read good things and things that are thoughtful. But I don't know that I can set out to do anything as, I don't want to say ambitious, but...
Baroque?
Well, you know, I can't be a John Irving. I don't write like John Irving, and I also don't write like Gaddis, so I have to find some middle road for myself. And I love Gaddis, and he used to be my favorite writer. I say used to just because I haven't read his books in so long, as we were discussing, my mid-20s. Well, and I read the last of his books, A Frolic of His Own, or A Frolic of Their Own, I can't remember.
A Frolic of His Own,
yeah. I did read that. I think that was actually published later than. But and that wasn't a big sprawling novel either. Yeah.
It was
sort of short for him. You know.
Did you read Agape Agape? Or?
You know, I haven't read that.
Yeah, so that one's like 90 pages or something.
Oh, no, I've never read that. I thought I had read all of him, but you're right. No, I haven't read that. Recognitions, J.R. What was the other sort of long, big one?
There was also Carpenter's Gothic, which is actually 300 pages.
Oh, yeah, right. In fact, you're right. Carpenter's Gothic is the shorter one.
Yes.
A Frolic of His Own is
it's
a little
like
bit longer.
400, 500.
That's right. That's exactly right. Carpenter's Gothic was actually not my favorite of his. I think J.R. was my favorite. But it is difficult for people to sit down in our sort of attention-deprived culture and read something that's 900 or 1,000 pages.
Yeah.
And so I do, I guess, write more for a contemporary readership that can't stomach such massive undertakings in a few sittings. I don't know.
I'm wondering, though, if accessibility should even be a question if you're setting out to write
a novel.
I
don't really think of that stuff anymore when I write. I just think of what I want to do and how I want to spend my time as a writer, and what gives me joy, really, is to write somewhat shorter things that aren't quite as dense as, you know, as Gaddis is.
Do you strive more for concision?
I do. I find myself becoming impatient with writers who are under-edited, I feel, you know, which everyone is now. I mean, we're all under-edited, essentially. But
well, particularly if you're going through Richard, who has his hands in numerous things over at Soft Skull. I mean, you know, do you really kind of have a good set of eyes with Richard, or do you have other eyes for this?
He is a good set of eyes. He's an excellent reader. But his interests are less in line editing, which I'm glad of, because really I don't want someone obnoxiously line editing me. But he does have a structural eye, and that's really important and hard to find. He's a very entrepreneurial publisher and editor. You know, he's entrepreneurial, and so a lot of his energy goes into reaching out.
So did this influence the writing of How the Dead Dream? I mean, it seems to me that
did Richard play a part? Richard's editorial style play a part?
Yeah, I'm curious, because I mean, here you are talking about writing a simpler, more accessible book in a certain manner, and yet this is a very interesting... Oh, that sounds very good, by the way, over the...
Excellent.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think so, because I just don't think that I'm able to be quite that mathematical in my approach. If I could actually calibrate things so carefully, it might be a good thing, but I just sort of sit down and look at the blank page, and for me, writing is all about loving to do it. Just for me, is that I know a lot of writers who have very tortuous sort of processes, and but I'm not like that. I'm happiest when I can be writing. I'm happiest when I can steal a few hours to do it. And it's the thing that just, you know, even if no one read my books, I would still write them, you know.
But I mean, on some level, you're going to be calculating, whether it involves getting the book together in a sort of non-publishing sense,
mm-hmm.
pretty much just getting the whole thing out there, as well as also thinking about things like the marketplace. And so I'm wondering, I mean, there has to be some extent that you calculate, or is this something that you just consciously resist as an author?
No, I don't think I consciously resist it. I just think I've grown out of it somehow. You know, and you're probably quite right it's a thing that requires calculation, or at least begs calculation. But I kind of do my thing, and whatever it ends up being. Of course, this is, you know, because it's three books that go together, it will end up being sort of a longer thing, a longer exploration into a certain world. It's just that I'm able to segment it, you know, into these different points of view with each of these books in a way that keeps it interesting for me. I find it difficult to maintain things like tone over a long book like O Pure and Radiant Heart.
Yeah.
It's just you get these really sort of slack, there's sort of slack pacing sometimes, and there's lulls. And I was interested with this book in trying to leave out the bits that I wasn't as interested in. You know, I didn't want to waste my own time. There's nothing worse than reading your own work and being bored. You know, and I didn't want to be bored by my own work, so I was trying for concision more than anything. I think just sort of instinctively for concision.
You would view this trilogy as kind of a 12-tone symphony, although you kind of do use different keys for each of the three volumes.
That's a very lofty way of putting it, but I like it.
Well, I also wanted to ask you about... I wanted to ask you about the desert and how this... I mean, we were talking about it earlier, about it being this desiccated landscape of gray. And you're in close proximity to it in Arizona.
Well, I don't think of the desert as being desiccated or gray, although it is arid. But my desert will be more desiccated in the future with global warming, actually.
Yeah.
It's predicted for, you know, an enormous drought, and that'll be very sad. But I actually live in a very green desert, and one that has, for example, more biodiversity than any other desert in North America, and also more biomass. There are a lot of plants, there are a lot of trees, there are a lot of cacti, succulents, there are all kinds of extraordinary creatures that live there, you know, so for me it's not gray at all. For me what's gray is the sort of human interstices between urban...
The human animal.
Agglomerations in the desert. So like, for example, driving from where I live outside Tucson to LA, if you drive along the 10, you know, it becomes increasingly gray and dominated by car dealerships and casinos and stuff like that. That's the gray part of it. But I find the desert very green, actually.
Okay. Fair enough. But I'm wondering, though, it seems to me that you're rather pessimistic about this inevitable future of global warming, and I guess is How the Dead Dream a way to channel or answer that pessimism? I mean, there is some hope, but there is some pessimism. I'm just getting
You know, we just were so accustomed to getting all this bad news about global warming and sort of the future of the natural world and wildlife. And I think we get too hopeless about it. People actually just can't stomach that hopelessness anymore, and they become cynical about it. And I don't embrace cynicism, really, in regard to these things. I think it's very...
Realism,
but you do have to have hope, and this book wants to have hope about these things. Though, you know, projections in terms of global warming and its effect on, you know, about a third of the world's species are projected to go extinct in the next century on current emissions trajectories, and it's a really grim scenario, but one we can tackle. I mean, there's the technology to tackle it. We just need the political will and the social pressure to force that political will. And so, yeah, I do. This book was written as a very direct, sort of, it wanted to be an infusion of hope into the struggle that we feel with these predictions of impending doom that we get. So, yeah, it is hopeful, I hope. I mean, I hope it's hopeful.
Maybe it's too abstract to at least make a judgment call on this. I mean, maybe the notion of it being an organic, spontaneous, uncalculated plane, a pasture to bear fruit, as we... my little malapropism from earlier. Maybe what this is, I mean, it seems to me that it's almost as if novel writing for you is something of a prism that balances off of your work in environmental policy and the like, and thinking in terms of nature and animals. I'm wondering, do you find this abstract territory to be a better way or a good way for you to dwell upon the more concrete realities, which involve more of a kind of Q&A scenario?
I do. You know, it's hard to find... a lot of poetry and art in activism, you know, and it's a grind. Activism is a grind, and I'm just an editor. I'm not a real activist, you know, but I'm around a lot of lawyers who are activists, and you do get tired of the fairly limited lexicon that world has. Like, the political world has a very limited lexicon, and I believe that people need to have another way to see these things, to see these issues, if you want.
This explains the presence of lawyers and businessmen in this book, too. It interacts for many of your books
as
well.
Yeah, lawyers are a powerful force.
Yeah. I mean, I'm wondering, though, is there a certain kind of personal experience you deal with? I mean, there's a particular kind of class that's pursued in the kind of people who T hobnobs with. And I found it to be interesting because the only way he can seem to escape from that is really just submerging himself almost in near the end, where he's in the jungle and the like. And I find this to be, speaking of this notion of whether the book is hopeful or pessimistic, well, I mean, it's almost as if, I mean, I found it somewhat pessimistic, but I also found it somewhat funny at the same time. And I'm wondering if humor is the way to make pessimism somewhat more hopeful, that the only way we can actually get things done is to laugh over something, and that I don't know, I'm just rambling.
Yeah,
here.
No, I mean, it's true, and I do think that, I mean, humor for me has to be a part of everything that I write. I mean, I'm not saying that it's always successful or anything like that, but it has to be part of it for me, partly because the lexicon I was just talking about is a very earnest one, and I get so sick of earnestness. On the other hand, I really don't have much time for the sort of cynicism that completely decries earnestness, you know, so I want to sort of forge a middle ground between those two, and that's why I end up having these very cartoonish characters, even in this book, which is a sort of a serious book, but there are all these cartoon-like peripheral characters, and I can never seem to give those up, you know, the Fultons and...
Well, they stand in juxtaposition against earnestness. I mean, what's so wrong about earnestness, though? I mean, how would you define earnestness?
That's a really good question. I guess it's just a sort of humorlessness that is purpose-driven, that talks only about... you know, that's a really good question, because people speak... You know, there's earnestness and then there's irony, and there are always these sort of twin poles, you know. And I want to live in a world that contains both of them, really. And so my books, and this one, certainly try to do that. I think that you can have irony without being cynical, and I think that you can have earnestness without being repulsive, you know, without being just sort of off-putting, but there's a way to talk seriously about things and still not be devoid of laughter, I hope.
I think what you're objecting to is not so much earnestness, because empathy and hope and doing something about things, that's a very earnest kind
position.
Of position.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't see anything necessarily wrong with that. But I think what you're...
It just has to be interesting. That's all.
Okay.
You know?
I think what you're objecting to more than earnestness is this kind of boilerplate mentality we have with the world, this inevitability, the mm-hmm. fact that this we're living in this, and it's very much in the book, too, this notion of just living by this particular system. I mean, we see T, and at the very beginning, I'm thinking, Jesus, this guy is going to be an absolute monster. I mean, yes, it's very JR-like and mm-hmm, all that, mm-hmm. but I keep thinking, there is no way at the very beginning that I think that this guy is going to change, and yet he does. Mm-hmm. And I think that really what this book may very well be about is just this notion of how we just are determined, more so, I think, in the last 10 years, to be on this rather obdurate track of existence, that this is the only life that we have open to us, seemingly. And yet, you know, if you just submerge yourself away from that, or even do something even remotely away from that, then you have this great possibility, this a lot more fun, you know?
A lot more fun, exactly. I want this all to be fun, the way that this stuff is discussed, instead of stultifying, you know, or instead of sort of drained of liveliness and hope. So yeah, I mean, you said it better than I could, and I wonder whether you would like another beer.
Oh, well, let me finish this one.
Okay.
Did you want to get another one?
I'm going to get another one, but...
Brief, okay, yeah. It's...
But you can say when. I can wait a minute if you'd like.
Oh, okay. Do you need one now, or...?
I can wait a minute.
Okay, okay. Or,
so we can continue.
We'll
it's just you were so articulate, I fear. I can't really...
No. I wanted to also ask about T breaking into accredited zoos, which would also bolster this
accredited.
Theory.
Important that they be accredited.
Yeah, that they be accredited, that there is no sort of...
Well, you would actually be amazed how many bad zoos there are still in this country. I mean, we think of sort of, you know, I don't know, the carnival mentality of the 19th century and how animals were treated, even up to, I mean, quite recently... And we think that we tend to think that that's a thing of the past, but in fact it's not. And there are all kinds of probably the majority of zoos, if you include small zoos and roadside zoos and things like that across the country, are still really inhumanely, for lack of a better word, managed. And animals still live in these despicable conditions. And so I didn't really want to involve him in that side of the zoo world. There are enough moral contradictions already inherent in his actions, you know? The idea of breaking into an animal's home in this zoo, and the idea of how compromised these animals are to start out with, and to what extent do they actually even represent real wild animals when they live in zoos? And there were all those things floating around already, and I didn't want to introduce the element of shitty zoos. So.
It's too much to throw at the reader, or...?
It's too much for me to research, and it's too sort of ambiguous a terrain to explore, I think. Maybe one best explored in other... In fact, part of my research for the book was just reading this book called A Different Nature, David Hancock's book about zoos, which talks a lot about how even accredited zoos and relatively good zoos are so... such terrible places for animals to live and for people to see them as well. For people, you know, yeah. Zoos can be bad places for people. But that stuff to me is a little bit better suited to non-fictional terrain, I guess.
I mean, I'm also thinking also of the incident in which the dad and his son are really antagonizing the bear in this book.
That was actually based on something I experienced myself.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, though, the worst incident I've ever seen of people being cruel to animals was actually in Barcelona, in the Barcelona Zoo, where I went to see the albino gorilla, Snowflake, the albino gorilla who died a few years ago. And this was back in the 90s that I went. And there were just all these people standing, I think it was orangutans, actually. It wasn't bears, certainly. I think it was orangutans. And these people, a large crowd of people, and not kids, they weren't kids, people were just standing there pelting them with garbage, you know. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, who needs to do that? Who wants to do that? And they were laughing and pelting these orangutans with garbage, and the animals were kind of scurrying away. It was an open sort of enclosure, obviously, and there was no glass. And I was very affected by that. And so that particular snippet, that particular scene, was based on something autobiographical, which is rare in my...
That's really interesting to me, because that moment when I read it, I felt that, oh, well, maybe we're being, I mean, I get where it's going, but it's also possibly a little on the didactic side. I mean, it's very interesting to me because this is taken from reality. And in light of what we were discussing earlier about the notion of having cartoonish characters or unearnest sorts of situations, it seems very interesting that what you would take from reality would be even crazier or even more, I mean, how do you negotiate?
I've always thought, you know, people talk about how, well, they feel that I write these extreme characters that are hyperbolic, or, but in fact, I mean, all of that is drawn from life. People couldn't, I mean, I don't want to be stale and say that truth is stranger than fiction, but it really, you know, is to a certain degree. I see a lot of extreme people in the world and extreme behavior, and I, just even in personal experience, you know, just a lot of really extreme humans. And so, yeah, that, you know, I really worried a lot in this book about didacticism, and I didn't want it to be that. I didn't want it to be pedantic and teacherly, and so I'm almost uncomfortable with scenes like that, but I included it anyway because I felt sort of emotionally compelled to. But it is. It's a worry, because when you're writing stuff that's so, it's such a linear book in a certain way, it's such a progression from A to B, there's a lot to be concerned about with regard to just seeming to be on a soapbox. And I don't really mind other people being on soapboxes as long as I enjoy the ride. You know, I just have to enjoy the ride. But it's an uncomfortable thing for me. I've always felt very uncomfortable at the idea that I would seem to be preaching.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you, because it almost seems that to some extent you're trying to shake off some of the dregs of Everyone's Pretty, in the sense of having, like, you know, references to KY and the cocaine and all that sort of stuff. And I'm wondering if this is an issue with you now as you move into this less Baroque, more kind of just intuitive form of novel, that you really are trying to, what do you do to make sure you don't shift into certain patterns that you know or habits in writing that you feel are possibly repeating or not as organic as what you've been sort of discussing here?
Well, I don't think it's really possible to avoid repeating, you know? I mean, you don't want to be literally repeating things from your old work. It's difficult for me to... The purest novel that I've written, in a sense, was My Happy Life, because that was just sort of... really without many external references, you know, and it was sort of, you know, inspired by things like Beckett, even though I wouldn't ever pretend to be any Beckett, you know. You, sir, are no John F. K. Jr. or whatever. You are... What was the quote? You, sir, are no...
You, sir, are no Jack
John
Kennedy.
F. Kennedy. Jack
Kennedy.
No Jack Kennedy.
Jack
right.
Kennedy.
Right.
Mr. Benson, yeah.
exactly. But that, and even that book did contain a few sort of humorous and broad moments, because I can't leave them behind. I'm too attached to them, I think. And it's, for me, the sort of kitsch and broadness always creeps in at the sidelines a bit in my books. And I'm not sure why that is. Probably a good shrink could explain why why I do that.
Well, how is this tied into the sort of socioeconomic import, this concern for larger issues and the like? I mean, in what sense does the sense of exuberance and the sense of writing the cartoons funnel the concentration for larger issues and vice versa?
That is a really good question. They almost sort of play off each other, I think. I guess I feel like I sort of line the coat of the book with cartoon, you know, and then the really warm stuff is on the outside. to really use a strained metaphor, I can't really seem to be without that sort of broader stuff. But I think it's because I like it. I just like to read it. You know, that must be it, essentially, that I just like to read these broadly drawn moments and characters.
You're the only reader who matters in terms of audience.
Well, you know, it's all you can really care about, finally, because you can't rely on other people to always read things the way you... Only you can read your books the way you really want to.
Would you say that the novel was as endangered as many species at the present time? Or?
well, not the novel, but maybe the literary novel. It's hard to... It's hard to make those kinds of prognostications. I mean, I think the novel probably will have extraordinarily long, long life as a form, because people just can't get away from, there's nothing else that can offer them that sort of interior narrative that the novel offers them. Whether people read good novels or not is really more the question, I think. I mean, will they read narratives in the novel form, you know, for as long as we know? I think they will. Because movies don't do it all, and other forms just don't do it all. They don't do it all for you. They don't allow you to feel that you're communicating with the dead the way that novels do. But again, it's so hard to know what kind of a shelf life truly ambitious novels can have in culture because of the way that publishing markets things now and how few good novels really get out to a lot of readers.
So literary equals ambitious to you?
No, not necessarily. There are plenty of novels that are literary that I don't find particularly ambitious. Literary just meaning that they have to do with language. I mean, that they actually have a consciousness of language and are interested in not just story, but the language that makes the story. So that's literary. Ambitious is, I think, innovation within that constraint. And it's hard to be innovative with novels. It's a hard thing. But also there are great novels, I think, that are ambitious in other ways, that aren't innovative with the form necessarily, but are innovative with the content.
Like what, exactly?
Well, I mean, that's a good question, and one that I would probably have to research to answer. I mean, because some are both form and content-wise innovative, and others are really sort of content-wise innovative because
now we're getting tuffed here.
You know, like I really like I love Lynn Tillman, for instance. Yeah. I think she's a really great writer, but it's not that she's formally that distinct from lots of other writers. She's interior, like Bernhard. You know, I've compared her to Bernhard when I write. Sort of, I've written a couple of sort of appreciations of her work. So, you know, Bernhard did that sort of interior, quasi-philosophical, but always personal narration before Lynn Tillman did. But I still think that she's ambitious and literary and quite brilliant. You know, things aren't always on. It's not always the first innovation that matters. Sometimes it's the elaboration of an innovation. You know, it's the bringing of that innovation to new readers in a different language or a different culture or whatever. She just strikes me as a good example because Bernhard is one of my favorite writers, and she's one of my contemporary American favorites. But I couldn't say that she's doing formally something that hasn't ever been tried before. It's just that her content is so excellent, you know, that I think she's important. That's a question that requires another beer.
Okay, fair enough. Well, you know, actually, with that in mind, Lydia, it was. Do you want to answer that question after a beer, or?
We can think about it, and if we can. Answer
and if we can answer it, okay. But
let's
if not,
answer it if we can answer.
Okay,
it.
Fair enough. Well, if we don't answer it, thank you very much.
And thanks for having me.
Okay. Yeah.